So at the Kala, we had a wonderful panel on Judaism and the law with Josh Hedrick, David Wolitz, and Bernie Bernstein. Is there a fourth? Am I missing someone? No, I don't think so. Right. And what I really enjoyed about that, and it was part, especially through Josh and David, David's a constitutional law professor, was the question of the principles that undergird the law. It's very easy to get lost in the forest, the black letter law, what is the verdict? And it's also important to think about the structure, the principles, the worldview that may undergird our sages' and rabbis' perspectives about human nature, about theology, about the good, the function of the good in society. So I want to talk a little about those things. I want that to be our focus. Mishpatim is a collection of expansions, to some degree, on the Ten Commandments. It's a furtherance of the law, and I want to talk about the ways in which we consider those at the margins, specifically migrants, refugees, the convert, and the poor. And what I think, I haven't come to conclusions, or at least not hard and fast conclusions about what the perspective is, but I'd like to think about it together, what the law's perspective and principle is, what its understanding of ideal human relations is, and what it might be suggesting that God desires of us. I would like to actually have a watch, too, because I don't want to... A discussion can go very long, so... So the key text that we start with in the parasha is Exodus 22, 20 through 21, and Exodus 23, 3, which I'll quote a little later. V'ger lo toneh v'lo tilchatzenu, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, kol almana v'yatom lo te'anun. This is something that Talmud says is referred to about 36 times in Torah. That the sojourner, the resident among you, you should not oppress, you should not force upon the migrants because you were such things in Egypt. And the widow and the orphan you should not oppress, you should not cause penury to. Some of those words I struggle to translate, and that's what our sages will note too, that they're somewhat rough at the edges and without clear referent what it means not to cause suffering to a poor person, a widow, or a stranger, or a orphan. I'm sorry, I'm a little fuzzy because I'm something in my sinuses and the kids have been up a lot at night, but I will try to be as clear in my speech as possible. So I think this concept that I want to read the law and the tradition through is best illustrated in this week's parasha by the Chazon Ish. This question that mitzvot and the particulars of halakha were given to teach life perspective, behavior, and values. It's not always clear. Kashrut's a great example. I mean, what is kashrut there to teach us? But this is often my perspective on religious practice. It's not origins as much as effects. What does the law, not where does it come from, not why do we build a sukkah, although I think that's very interesting too, but what is the experience of the sukkah and how does that affect us spiritually, morally, existentially? How does that affect our worldview? And to an extent, to think about that, you need to consider the worldview behind these things. So Maimonides, the Mishneh Torah, in his law code of the 11th century, 14-volume law code, he talks, the basic laws of the parasha, you shouldn't practice deceit on a foreigner, deceive a foreigner in business, and you should not pity the poor in judgment. That's verse 23:3. Don't show deference to a poor person in his dispute. Thoughts, questions thus far? ideally, people would live by their convictions. In the real world, not as often. There's a study, I can't recall the outcome exactly, but where you would take persons and have them read either a text about good behavior or some neutral text, and then they would stage an encounter in the hallway of someone rushing somewhere, can you help me? And what you were prefaced with, the sort of the tone that you were prefaced with had very little relation to it. I think the outcome that did have a significant effect was how much time you gave them. So if someone's in a rush, they're much less likely to be helpful.
The Bible does not trust us. I just got through reading that. So for each statement like you should do it, then the Lord says, and if you don't, there will be severe penalties. I'll slay you even if you aren't, you know, considerate and careful, and, you know, if you dare to injure the poor and the vulnerable.
I mean, I think you don't even have to go to the consequences, but just the fact that it teaches the law means it's not, doesn't trust us to be decent of our own accord.
Well, true, but it doesn't settle for just teaching as a guy, and there'll be penalties.
Right. So I've talked before about our sages' penchant to create false etymologies, or I think in schizophrenia you call it clang associations. Does anyone know that phrase? I'm fairly confident that's what it's called. It's sort of like a rough connection between two words that really isn't the right, the true etymology, but is a nice musical association. I don't know. I'd have to. I didn't confer with Jack or Rafe to see if Bach's interpretation of the word ger is true, but it's beautiful. As Tim O'Brien says, sometimes beauty is more important than accurate, truth and accuracy. So, truth should never get in the way of a good story. So the word tonne refers to disadvantaging a stranger, a sojourner, with words, whereas the word lo tichaletzenu refers to taking advantage of his status and robbing him of money. I'm going to skip ahead to the backside, actually. I think this is in verse... lines 40 through 46 of Chizkuni on the backside, right in the second paragraph, you don't abuse converts by using them to perform menial labor. Now, ger is used both for a convert and sometimes ger v'toshav, or ger toshav is a resident alien. But the perspective, I think the reason those two words are linked is the idea that someone would come among you, and I think it's not quite different that there are residents, there are citizens, and there are green card holders. I think that's legitimately a very parallel in our understanding of people's relationship to the nation. There are immediate citizens, there are residents, and there are those who have an intermediate status, and they all have, well, in some places it says you have to treat them with one law, and in some places it says, it suggests gradations. But Chizkuni, in line 43, we don't abuse converts by using them to perform menial labor, seeing by that definition, that by definition they are unfamiliar with the ways of Israelites and our culture, it would be easy to take advantage of their ignorance by assigning to them degrading work. They're like Guatemalans, busboys, is what I sort of picture. What? Aids, farm workers, yeah. I mean, some of that is economic, but some of it is, you know, it's very easy to take care of someone who's undocumented, take advantage of someone who's undocumented. I don't know if that's exactly what Chizkuni and the Torah are thinking about, but it's an interesting, it persists to our day that those at the margins are very easy to take advantage of, and our Torah and tradition is telling us that's not permissible. So, and Bach notes this. The Torah writes, we're on line 16 on the front side. The Torah writes many times about the need to treat a proselyte fairly, seeing that he's alone in a country in which he has no roots and no family who could protect him. That's often the same issue. That's why widows and orphans are put in the same category. Widows have no structure, social structure that protects them. You have to imagine a social status or a gender-assigned hierarchy that's much worse than our own, much different to our own, in that women have no protections outside of their father's family or their husband's family. They are very vulnerable, sometimes to prostitution, sometimes to destitution is certainly the most common thing that would happen to an unwed woman or a divorcee or a widow. They have no one left to provide for them, and there are no economic opportunities for them to provide for themselves. So, and likewise a proselyte. I mean, I think this gets to the idea of being an undocumented immigrant in America, but even being a foreign worker in Amsterdam. I was talking to someone who's trying to get a position with a firm in Amsterdam, and his impression is that will cost the firm $15,000 more, I don't know if it's annually or initially, to host an American for the job. You know, so there are great disadvantages. There are jobs that you can't do if you're not a citizen. Right? You're not allowed to participate in certain industries or many industries. I mean, Elliot Dorff says the same thing. He talks about our three Abrahamic faiths, that our master narrative is Exodus. Christian master narrative is incarnation and resurrection, especially resurrection. And Islamic master narrative is of submission to God's will. And that's what Islam means. And he makes a lot of really interesting conversation about what it means to have those different master narratives and the way you relate to the world and the way you understand your role in it and the way you relate to other people. I don't want to go too far in that. Let's look at Bachia, line 19, his etymology for the idea of ger, which is just really beautiful. I've never tested it anywhere else, but the word ger for a stranger is derived from gargir, an isolated berry at the far end of a solitary branch. I think it's a beautiful image. And that's, you know, those at the margin. It's a really wonderful and important part of my work to work with those at the margin, people who are not core to the Jewish community, people who are disaffected from our congregation, people who are not yet Jews. That's one of the places that I feel that I do my best work. And he knows. I think what's interesting is that they knew all of the things that we would suspect now. People have a habit of insulting strangers and belittling them. The Almighty will fight for them. And we should have empathy for them. Just as God took pity on us, God will do the same things. God cries out for the stranger. That's the line in, Parshat Bo, God heard our cry and came down to listen. I mean, you see that previously with the patriarchs and matriarchs, but it's interesting. To turn to page 2, just in the interest of time. Questions, comments, feedback so far? I don't know about if I love the stuff about sexual assault and then you have to marry the person. But. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I like the fact that the father could refuse to let his daughter be given to such a person unlike the
father's. I'm misspeaking. That's not so much about sexual assault. There are passages, I think it's in early Numbers or just in Deuteronomy where it talks about sexual assault leading to marriage, and that's one of the more discomforting things in the Torah for me. I don't know if I agree with all this stuff. I mean, this is where the practice of not reminding a convert, one of the places we get the idea that we don't remind converts that they are converts. Sifra is a very difficult, abstruse commentary on Leviticus. And it says, yes, you should never remind someone, yesterday you were an idolater and today you are under God's presence, meaning you've become a Jew. It's not okay. Whereas the criteria for entering into Judaism, the things you're supposed to say to admonish a non-Jew from becoming Jewish are very interesting. Like, you know, today you can eat bacon, but tomorrow you won't be able to eat bacon. I mean, it's more severe than that. You know, today, if you violated any Torah prohibition, nothing would happen to you. But tomorrow, if you become Jewish, you're going to, you know, go to, not heck, but, the, you know, have the punishments that a Jew would have. I don't know. This section from the Talmud, I struggle with the latter part. So Rabbi Natan says, a defect that is in you, don't mention it to another. Since Jewish people were themselves strangers, they should not be in a position to demean a convert because he is a stranger in their midst. And actually, I wish I had the original Hebrew because there's a couple pieces that I want to look at. I wonder if the word is specifically a convert or a, like a resident alien. This explains a local adage. And it's kind of neat. One neat thing in the Talmud, I don't know if anyone's ever collected them, is adages. Like things that have nothing to do with Torah and nothing to do with oral law. They're just things people used to say back then, which is, you get these kind of really neat things like, I forget the fox. There's one about a fox that's kind of cool. I don't remember them all. But I wonder if anyone's ever collected them. Sort of like aphorisms of the, you know, early, late ancient period. So there's an adage, one who has a person hanged in his family doesn't, you should not say to the member of that whole household, hang a fish for me, as the mention of hanging is demeaning to that family. That's a weird one. Unrelated to sort of the core topic we're talking about, I was thinking about that a lot this week. So I don't know if I agree, because there's this like weird, you know, never mention the child suicide again, never mention, you don't talk about people's physical deformities, and it's very painful for the many cases. I would say 90 to 95% of the cases, it's like the person knows, you know, I'm missing an eye and no one ever talks about it. But there's a great richness and a great spiritual power and pastoral power of talking about the thing that people just walk by and pretend they don't see, you know?
Actually, I can talk about that personally because please. I am deaf on one side and my family totally ignored it. They treated it by ignoring it, but being deaf that way causes you to have certain hearing problems. And for instance, my mom would not pay attention to whether I was seated at a family gathering, unable to hear anybody next to me, instead of making sure I was at the end, or that I can't localize sound.
Oh, yeah.
We'd have these interesting conversations where she'd want me somewhere, and she'd say, come here. I'd say, where? Here. Where? Here. And she'd
Did
matter, matter.
She knew, though, right? It wasn't like she didn't know. Doesn't go away. Right, right. If you had a family member who was executed by hanging or by any means, it's not like you forget about it, right? And not mentioning it ever. Sometimes it's nice. I mean, there are definitely people, you know, there was a recent horrible death, and when I see that family, sometimes we talk about the death, and sometimes we just talk about donuts. You know, like some people do need respite from constantly thinking about a difficulty or a tragedy in their life, but they need to be candid about it when it's appropriate. We shouldn't pretend. So, let's just read quickly the bottom of page 2 just so you get it. It's interesting. This is sort of the other end of taking care of the stranger. It's like, don't pretend that Nora and I were talking about this, actually, at Shabbat dinner. I think this is a statistically proven thing. I feel like I've heard this before. She has an African-American supervisor whom she feels gives her the worst evaluations because of their shared heritage. And I think there's statistics to bear that out. It's the challenge of it's very hard to treat someone neutrally and objectively. And I think what they're saying here is that if you're a poor person, don't show them deference. Just because someone is in need doesn't mean you treat them like a baby. You know? That challenge of treating people. I think it's nice to read this through with y'all because I think the issue is dignity. You know, I think the underlying principle is dignity. It's not they're pathetic. It's not they need our sympathy. It's that everyone deserves an equal serving of dignity. I think that's what I'm hearing. We often call that in Talmud kavod habriot, the honor given to all created things. Dignity. I think it's a very powerful concept. If you look, I think in Talmud Brachot, there's a long section of things that are trumped by human dignity, kavod habriot. Things that you can do. You know, we often talk about you can break Shabbat to rescue a life, but there are a lot of things you can do so you don't insult someone's dignity. Yeah, I don't know. You know, not all, there is, my classmate used to say it was very easy to see the patterns in the law, and I think it's very hard to see the patterns in the law. I don't think they have consistent rubrics, but I think you can try, meaning like, this is always kosher and this is never kosher, because I don't see the pattern there. But I think it's really interesting to try to elicit or infer the principles. And among the principles I'm hearing today is dignity. So.